are listening to African Perspectives with host Brother Oshi on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
Get to people, yeah. What are you gonna do? You are listening to African Perspectives, where we view the issues of our day from an African worldview and African-centered perspective. This program is unapologetically African. It is a custom in the African tradition to ask elders for permission to speak, having been granted permission. To our ancestors, whose shoulders we stand on, to our elders, whose shadows we walk in, I greet you, my dear brothers and sisters, in the language of one of the greatest civilizations on this planet. It gave the world the basic disciplines of knowledge of science, math, architecture, music, writing, law, religion, you name it, we did it. The Greeks called it Egypt, but they called themselves Kemet, and Kemet means land of the blacks. I greet you all in the Kemetic language, the word of peace, Hotep. It is truly an honor and a privilege to pour libation because we truly do stand on the shoulders of those who came before us. We're going to use water because water has no enemies. Water is the great cleanser, the great purifier. Everything on the planet that lives, it needs water, from a tiny microscopic organism to a tall redwood tree. We pour water into the earth to invoke the spirits of our ancestors, and we say the word Ashe. It simply means, so be it. So we pour this libation to God, for all that God has done and for all that God will do. We say Ashe. We pour this libation to Mother Africa, birthplace of all humanity, everyone who has lived, everyone who will live in the future. We all have a common ancestral root in Africa. We pour this libation to the classical civilizations of Africa. I mentioned Kemet in the opening. Kemet was the height, the apex, the zenith of African high culture. But there were others as well, as Timari, Punt, and Nubia. So we pour this libation to the classical civilizations of Africa. You say, Ashe? We pour this libation to the contemporary civilizations of Africa, of Ghana, Mali, Songhai, Benin, Great Zimbabwe, civilizations that were flourishing and growing while Europe was in a medieval or dark age. The University of Sankore at Timbuktu, an outstanding educational institution. So we pour this libation to the contemporary civilizations of Africa. We say, Ashe. We pour this libation to the Ma'afa, the Holocaust of our enslavement, the Infakani, the great tragedy, uprooted out of Africa. Our brothers and sisters lay a carpet along the Atlantic Ocean. We're in North America, South America, Central America, and throughout the diaspora. So we pour this libation to our brothers and sisters who suffered the Ma'afa, the Infakani, the Holocaust of our enslavement, the great tragedy. We pour this libation in their honor and in their memory. We do not know their names, but because of them and their sacrifice, we are here. So we say, Ashe. We pour this libation to those who fought against enslavement. If you ever heard me do a libation, you will know that we were not slaves. I repeat, we were not slaves. We were captives. What does a captive want to do? Get free. So we pour this libation to all those men and women who fought against enslavement. In fact, I maintain that some of us are more of a slave today than we were in our initial captivity, because some of us are a slave to vice, to corruption, to drugs, sex, and violence. So we pour this libation to those who fought against enslavement. Gabriel Prosser, Nat Turner, Dingmark Vesey, Harriet Tubman. We always resisted, and we will always resist. So we pour this libation in the name and the honor of those men and women who fought against our captivity. We pour this libation to those unborn, those young men and women who will once again lead us back on the stage of human history as a free and proud and productive people. We sashe. We pour this libation to brotherhood and sisterhood, together for the union of family. We need each other. We don't have good family life. There's a saying, conditions shape conduct and consciousness. The conditions in our community are bad. The conduct towards each other is not good. Because why? We lack consciousness. And consciousness is more than just awareness. Consciousness is a deeper understanding of who you are historically, who you are culturally. So once we begin to understand the importance of brotherhood and sisterhood together for the union of family. Brothers and sisters, let us all say, Ashe, Ashe.
You are listening to Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts or live programming, hit them up at timeforanawakening.com.
Good morning, African world. You are listening to African Perspectives here on the Motherland Media Network on timeforanawakening.com and blacktalkradionetwork.com. And I am your host, Brother Oshi. I know, my voice sounds a little bit different today, and I don't know, yeah. No, I don't have, I did drink a Corona, though. I did drink a Corona, but I don't have Corona. I don't have the coronavirus, you know. And that would be deep, wouldn't it? Man, I'd be the first brother in the state of Georgia or in the city of Atlanta with coronavirus, and no one knows how he got it. I wouldn't mind being the first brother to get coronavirus. I definitely don't want to be the first dude to die from coronavirus, okay? That's for damn sure. You're listening to African Perspectives here on the Motherland Media Network on timeforanawakening.com and blacktalkradionetwork.com. I hope you've had a good weekend. Hope you had a chance to do all the things you wanted to do, need do, should do, must do, can do, and will do. And I hope the weather was great for you to do it. But if the weather was not, I know you got it done anyway because you always persevere. You always meet the challenge. And that's why we love you. We're here every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., 10 to 12 Central, 9 to 11 Mountain, or 8 to 10 Pacific, or any other time around the world. But if you cannot listen to this program live, you can go to the archives at timeforanawakening.com. Look for podcasts, click on that. And then right away when you click on that, you'll see African Perspectives. Click on that, and then there will be programs that are dated and titled. Other programming that we have here on Time for an Awakening Media. This evening, Monday, from 6 to 8, Acres of Diamonds Public Affairs Programming out of Philadelphia with Brother Wahad, followed by Let's Buy a Black 365 from 8 to 9, and then Conversation, Reparations with Brother Jamoke and Sister Lacey from 9 to 10. On Tuesdays, Black Reality Think Tank with Dr. William Rogers on Tuesdays from 8 to 10. Then on Wednesdays, Revive with Sister POC, Proof of Consciousness from 8 to 10 on Wednesdays. On Thursdays, Relationships with Joy and Troy at 7 p.m. on Thursdays. And then on Fridays, if it's Friday and it's 8 p.m. Eastern, that's right, brothers and sisters, it's Time for an Awakening with Brother Elliot and Brother Richard. Time for an Awakening. And then on Sunday, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., no, it ain't me. It's Sister POC again with her program Revive on Sunday from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. And then Sunday evening at 7 p.m., Time for an Awakening with Brother Elliot and Brother Richard. Last night he had on the program Sister Ava Muhammad. Good conversation. And then Monday through Friday at 10 p.m. Eastern to 12 a.m., it's the Warm Valentine Show right here on Time for an Awakening Media. And the number to call is 215-490-9832. 215-490-9832. We Buy Black. WeBuyBlack.com, get everything you need from the largest online marketplace for American African-owned businesses is WeBuyBlack.com. Get everything you need from American African-owned businesses from WeBuyBlack.com. I mentioned the sad reality of WeBuyBlack.com not having a kiosk in the Greenbrier Mall anymore, which is right across from the Medu bookstore. That's unfortunate. But go to their website, WeBuyBlack.com,
and those products would be available to you. It was just a more of a convenience to be able to go to the Greenbrier Mall and pick those products up personally. But they're right there, so please support WeBuyBlack.com. Africa for the Africans. Africa for the Africans, Brother Bamani Tayembe, who has been taking our people to the motherland consistently for the last number of years, literally hundreds of our people. They've been doing it for quite a long time, I think 06, something like that. AfricaForTheAfricans.org, the number to call, Brother Bamani Tayembe, 404-931-9429, 404-931-9429. His trips this year, the first one is April 3rd through the 13th, going to Senegal and Gambia for $3,300. The next trip, the Ghana Repatriation and Investment Tour, May 25th to June 5th for $3,700. The next trip, South Africa Roots and Culture Tour, November 20th through November 30th for $3,700. And then the final trip of this year is Ghana Repatriation Investment Tour again, December 24th through January 5th, 2001, for $3,700. Once again, he's going to start back in April 2nd through the 12th of 2021, going to Senegal and Gambia again for $3,500. Brothers and sisters, for a $400 down payment on any one of these trips and an easy payment plan, interest-free, you have and everything that you need. He has the documents and so forth, all the stuff that you need. So go online to AfricaForTheAfricans.org. Also, too, if you want to see pictures of previous tours, Facebook.com/Bomani. If you want to see videos, go to YouTube.com/Bomani2007. Renoko Rashidi, my good brother Renoko Rashidi, he has a trip coming up. His trip is going to Uganda and Rwanda. What great pictures he has. Go to his website, Dr. Renoko, drrenoko.com, drrenoko.com. He also has another trip, and that is going to Egypt, to Kemet, October 27th through the 4th, October 22nd through the 4th of November of this year. Two outstanding trips by Brother Renoko. I think both trips are like $4,200, around $4,200. And once again, he has the same type of setup, payment plan, down payment plan for you to make it convenient for you to make that trip. And I hope that shall do, because that is going to be really nice. That's just a good trip right there. Going to Kemet, but looking at Uganda and Rwanda, and I'm very interested in Rwanda. So I may not do this trip, but I'm quite sure you have another one coming up, so I'll be ready for it. Habesha stands for helping Africa by establishing schools at home and abroad. Habesha programs. No, Habesha's mission is a Pan-African organization that cultivates leadership in youth and family through practical experiences in cultural education, sustainability, agriculture, entrepreneurship, holistic health, and technology. They are doing the work, brothers and sisters. Please believe. Habesha Works Program, Black to Our Roots, Sustainability Seeds with the young people, helping young people, and of course the Golden Growers. People like myself, they are doing the work. They have an investment program called Kashi, the Kashi Project. Kashi is named in honor of the world-renowned Ghanaian ethnobotanist, Dr. Kwaku Adu. Dr. Adu was dedicated to research in ethnobotany and traditional medicine, and he was dedicated to Ghana. Kashi will provide a sacred space for researching the ancient traditions of sustainability housing, holistic healing, organic agriculture. In the footsteps of Dr. Adu, we are committed to our people, Ghana, and sustainability through natural resources. In order to make Kashi reality for the community and for the people, we are raising $250,000 through various fundraising efforts. Habesha is committed to doing our part to build Kashi in Africa, but we can't do it alone, so they need your help. They're right at about 130,000, so obviously they need more help. But believe me, when you see the pictures of what they have proposed and what they have planned, you want to be a part of it. Beautiful. Yeah. Sustainability. It's beautiful. Shrine of the Black Madonna. Shrine of the Black Madonna, located here in Atlanta on the West End on Ralph David Abernathy. The store hours are Wednesday through Saturday from 12 to 7. Sunday from 1 to 3. They're closed Monday and Tuesday. They have an African Holocaust Museum. And they have everything you need. They got furniture. They got clothing. They got artwork. But more importantly, they have books. And if they don't have the book that you are looking for, believe me, they'll get it. They also have a history program every Saturday, an African history program of Know Thyself, where Brother Baba Olatunji is the instructor or the guide. And the time on Saturday, and it's free and open to the public on Saturdays, 1:30 to 3:30 at the Shrine of the Black Madonna. But if you want that information, you can attend those classes. They also have an African History Club multimedia library, which is now 7 terabytes of African enlightenment. 7 terabytes of African enlightenment. So, dear brothers and sisters, check out the Shrine of the Black Madonna. Another bookstore I promote, because, you know, I'm always promoting books, because, I mean, the most important thing that we as African people can do is to read with comprehension and understanding. Read what our ancestors have wrote. Read what our elders have wrote. Read what our contemporaries have written, particularly about independence, self-determination, liberation, and sovereignty for African people. The Medu Bookstore in the Greenbrier Mall, if you were by the kiosk of We Buy Black, is right there, but hey. But the Medu Bookstore, in fact, Mama Nia, I'm going to go see her this week to schedule my African history program that I'm going to do right there at the Medu Bookstore. I'm very honored to do that, and hopefully some of you who are listening can be able to attend, come to the Greenbrier Mall and check it out. The bookstore opened Monday through Saturday from 10 a.m. to 9 and Sunday from 12 to 6. And the number to call is 404-346-3263. 404-346-3263. The Medu Bookstore in the Greenbrier Mall. Another bookstore that I promote is Brother Gazende Ajamu of Black Dot, located in Lithonia. Black Dot, and that's Brother Gazende Ajamu. Give him a call. He also has the red, black, and green shoes, as well as the shrine. They have the red, black, and the guy's shoes. So they're ready for you. So you be ready. Akabin Institute, Brother Baba Rudy and his lovely wife, Yaba Rudy, have been educating our young warriors, and they need our support.
This call is being recorded.
They need our support, and that's what we should do, dear brothers. We should support them. We need our support. Akabin Institute, P.O. Box 10786, Atlanta, Georgia, 30310. Baba Barudi's, you just can't, I'm going to tell you. Okay, also, too, if you want to pay by PayPal or Cash App, go to those places, go to those sites, PayPal and Cash App, put in a dollar sign, the word YAHYAA, the letter M, then Baruti, B-A-R-U-T-I, and make your contributions to Akabin Institute to further the education of our young warriors. Sister Gabby sent me about 20 pictures the other day from Haiti, from Haiti, in the northeast corner. She's in the rural area in the northeast corner of Haiti. Sanjay-Haiti, Sister Gabrielle Aurelia, Sister Gabby, and doing fantastic work. Go online to Sanjay, Sonje-Haiti, AYITI.org, and look at the fantastic work that this sister is doing. The Inye Sesim of Daily Revolutionary Thought. The Inye Sesim. March 1st. Blessed are those who struggle. Oppression is worse than the grave. It is better to live for a noble cause than to live and die a slave. The Last Poets. Nation building starts when individuals and their families develop their knowledge base and talents and join with other like individuals and families. From these increasingly larger, extended families, communities will form because we recognize the immensity of our struggle to regain ourselves as African people and the forces which quickly materialize against any highly visible, undeveloped, massive nation building effort. We know that we must start small and sure. We must start small and sure, not haphazardly. We recognize that public advertising, mass organizing, loud voices, and flamboyancy have done little but serve individual egos and set us up as easy targets for imperialistic predators. Therefore, we know that if we are to be successful in this critical endeavor, we must quickly do the work of building the foundation of a nation that will close ranks gradually over the coming generations. It is no secret that this will be a difficult struggle. The wisdom of African teaches us that when a stick is bent far in one direction, it will have to be bent even further in the other direction in order to again become straight. So, if we are to do this right, then we must value the lessons that come through the weight of the many generations that it will take to turn our families back into a nation and back to African sovereignty. Affirm, I am intrepid nation builder. Affirm, I am an intrepid nation builder. March 2nd. The melting pot is about to boil over. The devil's brew that they have seasoned with our dreams, with our lives, is about to spill out unto the fires of justice, the fires that rages in the bosom of each one of us here. In Xavier Arnold. The need to include everybody in our war, especially those who boast about sustaining in the deepest states of menticide, who hate the idea that someone might think that somewhere in them there might be anything recognizable as African, is extremely problematic. If we have to get over anything, it is the idea that it is necessary to bring everybody into the fold in order to win. This is the diversity scam working its finest magic on the minds of those Africans seeking an easy way to peace. It is the idea that everyone of African descent must be brought into the decision-making fold because we think we are a democratic family. It intentionally forces us to overlook the fact that there are those in our families who hate us. I repeat, there are some people in our families who hate us for changing our names and wearing our hair natural and, yeah, for real. The diversity scam operates on the principle that you cannot make revolutionary progress without everybody included. It is so easy to become completely misdirected when believing that everybody must be together in order to return home, mentally, physically, emotionally, and spiritually. Affirm, alone or in the company of millions, I see a victorious African future. Affirm, alone or in the company of millions, I see a victorious African future. Bibi Fortier, Bibi Fortier family, our victorious destiny. The Enye Sesem of Daily Revolutionary Thought. The Enye Sesem. Brothers and sisters, I appreciate. Sorry about that. Yeah. What did I do? I touched something. Okay. Long as I'm still on the air and I still can be heard. That's the bottom line. Sometimes, you know, the technology trips you up. I'm going to be, I won't be broadcasting this Friday because Thursday I'm going to Tulsa, Oklahoma. I'm going to be a part of a delegation of actually really firefighters The state senator, who was a firefighter in Oklahoma, in Tulsa, and he was a firefighter, and he trained at our training program, our educational training program. And first it was at FAMU, then it went to Dillard University. Then when Katrina hit, it went to Atlanta. It came here to Atlanta for 5 years. And then it went back to Dillard, where it presently is. And so he visited last year and gave a presentation, and he said he would like for us, those of us who deal with history and so forth, to be a part of a delegation. So myself, Brother Yusuf Muhammad, who you heard me mention his name many times before, he has a radio program on Blog Talk, Disaster Awareness for Community Preparedness, and he's been on this program a number of times, Brother Yusuf Muhammad. Our president, Addington Stewart, the chairperson of the Dr. Carl Holmes Executive Development Institute, EDI, Brother David Washington. Brother Muhammad's out of New York, but he presently lives in Virginia Beach. Addington Stewart is out of St. Louis. David Washington is out of Las Vegas. David Washington was a former chief of Las Vegas Fire Department. Addington Stewart's retired, and of course, Brother Muhammad's retired, as well as I. Oh, another person. The lovely, my good sister, Rosemary Cloud. Rosemary Cloud was a firefighter here in Atlanta, and then she was appointed the chief by Dr. Asa Hilliard's wife, Bessie Jo Hilliard. She was the mayor of East Point, Georgia, and she appointed Rosemary Cloud as the chief of East Point, Georgia Fire Department. And that made history. And right before I went to Ghana last year, they had a dedication. They built a new fire station and named it in her honor, Rosemary Cloud. And so she'll be also attending. I think there's somebody else too. I might be forgetting somebody. I hope not. But so we're going to meet and we're going to discuss. And I believe they're trying to figure out how to present this information. They don't want me because I ain't sugarcoat nothing, okay? They don't want Brother Oshie. Well, you know, I'm a very respectful person. There's no doubt about that. At least I know that to myself I am, you know. But one thing that I'm not, I don't. At this stage of my life and at this stage of our struggle, you know, I don't hold my tongue. You know, I don't try to give pleasantries. I don't try to appease anybody. I'm not antagonistic. I'm not overly, you know, crash or anything like that. I believe I'm a respect. I know I'm a respectable man, you know. But by the same token, you know, I have no fear. I have no fear. If the European wants to come and take me out, he just takes me out. But I'll go down fighting. Because of my intense love and respect for African people, I'll go down fighting, you know. And because I'm going to be in Tulsa this weekend, and maybe I'll be invited back next year, because next year is the commemoration of the massacre in Tulsa. And in fact, what's interesting about that, I was trying to figure out, when did I learn about some of these? I know that I learned about Tulsa back in the late 60s in that program where I started learning about a lot of stuff, the Black National Anthem, Marcus Garvey, Lewis Latimer, you know, a number of people that I had, James Weldon Johnson, who wrote the Black National Anthem or the Negro, whatever. But I didn't learn about a lot of others. In fact, the Rosewood I didn't learn about until the 80s when I was vice president of the NAACP. When talking with Dr. James Cameron, created the Black Holocaust Museum here in Milwaukee after having visited the Holocaust Museum in Israel, the European Jews Holocaust Museum in Israel. And he created the Black Holocaust, which he got some flack from, but there were some European Jews who helped give some funding to Brother James Cameron. And James Cameron's story is deep out of Marion, Indiana. Of course, the Indiana, Illinois, especially downstate, downstate, south of Indianapolis, south of or down south of Springfield in Illinois, hotbeds for the Klan. And so Brother Cameron was hanging out with these two other brothers, and those two other brothers decided to rob a Caucasian couple who were sitting in the car. I guess they were trying to make out. I don't know, you know. And they were confronted, and I think both of them were killed. And so the townspeople gathered up the two brothers. There's a very famous picture. I don't know. You've probably seen it. The one where the crowd is around, there's a little girl there, and it's a Caucasian man who's pointing up at the two brothers who are hanging, who have been lynched. And James Cameron was about to be lynched, but James Cameron had nothing to do with it. He left. And as he tells the story, he's saying that I was miraculously saved. Excuse me. I was miraculously saved, you know, from the hangman's noose. And he left Marion, Indiana. He was on 60 Minutes. In fact, if you can go to YouTube, 60 Minutes, and put in his name, James Cameron, Time of Terror, and you can see his piece on 60 Minutes. And in various other programs Dr. Cameron was on, and very beautiful man. In fact, I seen up on Facebook when they had his anniversary. I was still in Milwaukee then, and I was blessed to do the libation. It was held at City Hall. I think it was his 90th birthday or 100th. Might have been 100th. Anyway, had a lot of good conversations. I saw Dr. Cameron as he was developing his museum over the many years from the various places that it was, and talking with him. Very good man, you know. But the reality is, you know, is that let me say this again. I don't hate anybody. I hate no one. I have a love for humanity because I recognize that humanity, that we are the fathers and mothers of humanity, that African people taught the world. Many people came from far and wide to sit at the feet of African people. African people taught Europeans. The foundation that Europeans hail as Greece was taught by Africans. In fact, when Greeks went back with that knowledge, some of them were, you know, were chastised. Socrates was made to drink hemlock, made to drink poison. Plato got his hat. He checked out, stayed in Kemet for, I don't know, I think about 15 years or so. Then he came back with all this knowledge that he had, you know, the great philosopher, and all the other things that the Greeks stole or appropriated to claim as their own, as the father of this and the father of that and the father of this. It's just like Hippocrates and the Hippocratic Oath. Contained in, he's the father of medicine, but contained even in the Hippocratic Oath is the word Aesculapius, which is Imhotep. It's translated into Imhotep. He gives credit to Imhotep, who lived thousands of years before Hippocrates and before the Greeks. Thousands. You got to understand that Kemetic world is 5,000 years old. And at the time the Greeks were there, it was 3,000 years old. You know? And so we taught them then. And then when Rome fell and Europe was in a dark age, the only light in Europe was in Western Europe with the Moors. More African people. We taught them again. We taught them again. We gave the world its first humanity. And what's going on in the world because of Europeans is not humane. It is not civil. That's why it's a true misnomer that they bring civilization. They didn't bring a damn thing to anywhere but death and domination and destruction. I don't hate them. I love humanity. But what I hate a system that they created that gave themselves the top position with everybody else at a lower position, with us at the lowest position. That's why you see around the world today, as Dr. Clark aptly stated, we have no friends. We have no friends. If you keep track of what's going on in the world, you'll know that we have no friends. You want a friend? Go look in the mirror. And don't leave that mirror till you like what you see, not your arched eyebrows or the shape of your pretty nose or that cleft or those dimples in your cheeks and that cleft in your chin. No, 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 no. Don't leave that mirror till you like who you see historically, culturally, and like those who look like you. Have a respect and admiration and love for those who look like you. We have no friends. And because of what they have done and what they continue to do, what they have done and what they continue to do. So, no, I don't hate Caucasians, but I hate the system that they created that put us in this position. It puts a system that perpetuates individualism, which is not an African way. But yet, that's why it's very hard for us to come together. Individualism, materialism, deep materialism, greed, selfish and greedy, don't want to share, would rather blow it up than to share with anybody. And of course, violence. They are the most violent people on the planet. I've often said, and I will continue to say, one thing that I've known about the history of Europeans, they've always found a better way to kill your ass. That's right. From a rock to a sword to a spear to whatever, a club to Gatling guns and catapults. And you ever check out the Inquisition when all that torture was going on, all the things that they created to torture somebody? You know, these are some sadistic people. They're very violent prone people. Very. And so I'm saying that to say there really is, you know, even though we bring these things up, I don't believe. And those of us who are in the African-centered movement, the Pan-African movement, do not believe there is any reconciliation with Caucasians. It's Pan-Africanism or perish. It's unify or die. So I'm going to talk about Wednesday about Tulsa, focus on Tulsa. But I'm going to talk this morning, about some other massacres, some other times that Caucasians vamped on our community. And, of course, no one was ever, you know, they just vamped on our community. Sometimes under the disguise of some Caucasian woman was accosted or raped or had sex or whatever. Sometimes just out of mean-spiritedness, just mean, evil, jealous, and selfish, you know. Especially like Rosewood. Well, Rosewood had a Caucasian woman who claimed that some brother had, because she was very promiscuous. She was a very young girl. If you've seen the movie Rosewood, Ving Rhames, and let me tell you the irony of that movie. John Voight in that movie plays the grocery store person who helps brothers get on the train to get out of Rosewood before they're killed by the white mob, the Caucasian mob. And, of course, John Voight is an avid supporter of Donald Trump. And to me, if you are a supporter of Donald Trump, I'm even talking to those Negroes that they had at Black History Month. And them cats was kissing, and especially, what's that, Diamond and Silk, oh, just kissing his, they breast smell like doo-doo, all that kissing his ass. You know, so, but John Voight, in fact, I think Trump gave him some kind of award or something like that. Well, I mean, he plays a character, I mean, just like everything else, you know. I look at it like when you do something like that, just like when I was a kid, I watched John Wayne movies. I never forget watching Hondo, you know, stuff like that. But when John Wayne opened his mouth and said what he said, I never watched another giant. Same thing with Elvis Presley. When I saw the article said, there ain't nothing that a nigga can do for me but shine my shoes and buy my records. The last Elvis Presley movie I watched was Viva Las Vegas. At the show, I went to the show and saw it. In fact, there was a theater in Milwaukee on North 27th Street in Lisbon. And then about, I'd say, because you know there was a lot of neighborhood theaters back in the day. Back in the day, there was tons of neighborhood theaters. And the other theater was down the street from it, like, I'd say at least about a half a mile at that, maybe less. And they showed that theater, the one on 27th Street on Lisbon, they showed Vincent Price movies, you know, monster movies, all kind of stuff like that, which I loved, you know. The one, other one, they showed Elvis Presley movies, Disney movies, stuff like that. Anyway, so I'm going to talk today, and I'm going to use some of the video that you'll listen to from these situations that have happened when Caucasians felt that y'all got too much. Because, you know, just like they did in Tulsa, just like they did in Roseville and other places, they vamped on our community, stole whatever they wanted to steal, and then burned those places to the ground, killing just men, women, and children for those who couldn't escape, throwing them in mass graves and so forth. And then nothing happened. There was a verdict in the Lane, Arkansas, which is one of my favorite, because I just found out about Lane, Arkansas a few years ago. So, let's get off into this. Race, culture, I say, you know, there's no such thing as race, but I use the word culture. So, when there's a, you know, thing that I've done and I'll continue to do is substitute words that I feel are more appropriate. And that's what we really should do, because it gives us, just like when you say the word slave, you almost automatically put our face on that word. There are other human beings that have been in servitude, but you automatically put, because you've been trained to, because the Caucasian constantly calling us slaves, the slaves, you know. And it's just like other words that I can get off into. But I use culture, not race. The culture massacres that devastated American Africans. Today's news broke that researchers believe the death toll for the 1921 Tulsa, Oklahoma, and this is written by Clay Kane, massacre, which came to some people's attention for the first time due to the HBO series Watchmen, might be a much higher than originally reported, and the figure was 36. They said, well, 3,300. According to the Washington Post, a team of forensic archaeologists who spent weeks using ground-penetrating radar at three sites in the city announced Monday that they have found anomalies consistent with mass graves that warrant further testing. In May of 1921, a 17-year-old Caucasian girl accused an American African teenager of assault in a downtown elevator, and Caucasian terrorism ensued. While the exact death toll is not yet clear, you don't have to be a forensic archaeologist to surmise that it is way beyond 36. There have been countless reports, including from TulsaHistory.com, that 300 or more people were murdered in an act of bloody Caucasian terrorism. The media of the time downplayed the destruction of the successful American African known community as Black Wall Street. If Watchmen was your first time hearing about the brutal massacre of 1921 and American African Black Wall Street, you shouldn't stop there. Massacres were commonplace and are blatantly and purposefully ignored in history books. Here are five such massacres you should be aware of. The Colfax, Louisiana Massacre of 1873. The Colfax. Despite some people claiming America was great for American African people, 7 years after the Civil War, American African men, women, and children were being massacred in plain sight. One of the most horrific incidents, at least that we know of, was April of 1873 in Colfax, Louisiana. Approximately 153 American African men were murdered by Caucasian men with guns, cannons, for trying to freely assemble at a courthouse. Sadly, the exact number of deaths is unknown because many American African bodies were thrown into what is called the Red River. So I got to, let me see if I can do this right here.
Educators and historians alike often overlook the Colfax Massacre, a very bloody yet crucial event that transpired during the Reconstruction. The massacre set possibly one of the most critical judicial precedents of the century in U.S. versus Cruikshank, a decision that would come to be regarded by many as one of the worst Supreme Court decisions in American history. After the Civil War, the commencement of Reconstruction signified both new beginnings and new opportunities for African Americans in the South. Southern Democrats, particularly farm owners, felt betrayed and knew not what to do with their land and plantations without a workforce to tend to their needs. With the passage of the 14th and 15th Amendments, the future looked bright for blacks who wanted to have their voices heard, and even the opportunity to participate in voting and politics, which further infuriated Southern whites. On April 13th, 1873, exercising their new First Amendment right to freely assemble as citizens of the U.S., a large group of black Republican freedmen gathered in a courthouse in Colfax, Louisiana. An armed group of about 300 white Democrats from the paramilitary group the White League descended on the courthouse and killed anywhere from 80 to 150 of the freedmen. Of the freedmen killed, about half were murdered in cold blood. Historian Eric Fauner deems it the bloodiest single act of carnage in all of Reconstruction. After such a gory affair, it seems that the men of the White League should have been easily convicted in a court of law. However, of all 300 men, only 9 were brought to trial, and all were acquitted. Furthermore, in U.S. versus Cruikshank, the Supreme Court ruled that the federal government had no power to protect the newly freed slaves from simple murder, and that the Due Process and Equal Protection Clauses only applied to state action and not the action of individuals. It stated specifically, "The 14th Amendment prohibits a state from depriving any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, but this adds nothing to the rights of one citizen against another." Because freedmen were no longer protected by the Constitution, they were left to the mercy of racist state governments. Because of U.S. versus Cruikshank, the Equal Protection Clause of the Constitution was essentially null and void. The KKK was allowed to use violence and fear tactics to suppress black voters, or those they thought were out of line. As whites dominated southern legislatures, they simply turned a blind eye to the violence against blacks, refusing to acknowledge racial hate crimes or persecute those who committed them. The federal government was left powerless to intervene or protect black citizens. Perhaps worst of all, U.S. v. Cruikshank set a grisly precedent and is still being cited in the present day to block gun control laws, civil rights cases, and most recently, the Violence Against Women Act.
What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over...
All right. That's one. And we're going to explore the others. Then have some conversation. Let me see if I can get this one in before I take a break, and then after the break, we'll listen to the others. In fact, I'll do this one and then take a break. It's longer, but you know, we don't necessarily have to take a break at 12 o'clock. You know that. So, but this is the Wilmington, North Carolina massacre of 1898. By 1898, Wilmington, North Carolina was a thriving area with a majority American African population. There was also several American African elected officials forcing Caucasians to share power. Of course, the threat of Negro rule created illogical Caucasian racial resentment. In addition, the media frequently reported erroneously that Caucasian womanhood was threatened by American African men. A Caucasian Wilmington newspaper printed a speech by Georgia feminists that read, "If it is required lynching to protect woman's dearest possessions from ravaging drunken human beast, then I say lynch 1,000 Negroes a week if it is necessary." By the election of 1898, American African men were prevented from voting to push out the American African elected officials. However, Caucasian supremacists would not stop, the Caucasian extremists would not stop economic power that Africans, American Africans had already created. Therefore, they destroyed Wilmington with terrorism. The day after 1898 elections, Caucasians announced the Caucasian Declaration of Independence. They overthrew the Wilmington government, destroyed the printing press, forced out the mayor, and a mob of Caucasian men attacked the residents. There were reportedly 60 to 300 people killed by domestic terrorism. For over 100 years, the powers that be in Wilmington tried to erase the massacre from its history until 2000, the year 2000, when the General Assembly established the 1898 Wilmington Massacre Commission to develop a historical record of the event as to assess the economic impact of the massacre on the American African local and across the region of the state. The massacre is now in the state record. So we're going to listen to this one, and then we'll take a break and we'll have some more. But you can join the conversation if you want to by dialing 215-490-9832.
In Wilmington, North Carolina, there was one thing you weren't allowed to research.
We were refused. We were rejected by the librarian.
When I asked about or inquired about 1898, they wanted to know why.
I was told that, yes, they had something, but they kept it under lock and key.
The story of Wilmington in 1898 still isn't widely known.
What happened here on what's now just this empty patch of grass would radically change racial politics in North Carolina.
This is the story of an American election, but also of something we don't usually find in American history. The violent overthrow of a democratically elected government. In the late 1800s, Wilmington, North Carolina was the state's largest city. It had a majority black population, and historians today describe it as a rarity in the post-Civil War American South.
Wilmington, prior to November 1898, was what the New South could be at the cusp of the 20th century.
There was an unusual degree of black prosperity.
In Wilmington, there were successful black entrepreneurs, doctors, teachers, but also black elected officials. And for a time, that was true throughout the state. Take a look at the politicians on this poster of the 1889 North Carolina House of Representatives. Here at the bottom are black Republican representatives, some from Wilmington. North Carolina also sent four black Republicans to the U.S. Congress between 1875 and 1899. The Democratic and Republican parties of 1898 in many ways occupied opposite parts of the political spectrum than they do today.
Most African Americans were voting for the Republican Party, and the Democratic Party was white voters almost exclusively. White supremacy was the central focus of the platform for the Democratic Party.
Republicans in North Carolina were successful in part because of a third party called the Populist Party, made up of mostly white farmers fed up with the tough economic times. North Carolina populists joined up with Republicans to form what they called the Fusion Party. And in the elections of 1894 and 1896, the Fusion Party defeated the Democrats in sweeping victories statewide. That meant North Carolina now had a government that shared power between black and white politicians, including a newly elected Republican governor. Together, they moved towards reforms that would favor black Americans and working class whites.
This was something that the Democratic Party folks were simply not going to accept.
A multiracial government wasn't just a disappointment for Democrats. It was more like a humiliation.
they needed a plan to take back control of the state in the next election. So party leaders like Fernifold Simmons, future U.S. Senator, Charles Aycock, future North Carolina governor, and this man, Alfred Moore Waddell, came up with one. To beat the fusion party by luring white populist voters away from their alliance with black voters. Wilmington, with a large black population and a local fusion government in power, would be a focus of their campaign. The State Democratic Party Handbook for 1898 laid out their goal: consolidate the white vote by stoking white anger and resentment. It said, "This is a white man's country, and white men must control and govern it." Their most effective tool was the media. One of North Carolina's biggest newspapers was a Democratic Party mouthpiece. It ran racist political cartoons throughout 1898.
Not everybody was literate in 1898, but to see a political cartoon of the type that ran, you may not be able to read it, but you know exactly what it means.
Many of the cartoons were centered on the threat of Negro rule, even though the fusion government was mostly white. They also played up another fear.
Black men threatening white women became a theme. White men need to do all that they can to protect white womanhood.
This was all part of North Carolina Democratic strategy, but it echoed the national racist rhetoric of the time. In one speech that Democrats printed in Wilmington paper, a prominent Georgia writer named Rebecca Felton said,
"If it takes lynching a black man a day to protect white womanhood, I say lynch."
Her speech prompted a Wilmington black man named Alex Manley, owner of the Black Run Daily Record newspaper, to respond with a column. He made a simple observation that, at the time, was shocking.
That white women who had liaisons with black men did so voluntarily and enthusiastically.
Manley wrote, "Every Negro lynched is called a big, burly black brute, when in fact, many were sufficiently attractive for white girls to fall in love with them."
Manley pretty much said, in a nutshell, sometimes white women choose to be with black men.
Manley's editorial became another tool for Democrats. Newspapers reprinted it, called it a horrid slander, and ran comments about it on a daily basis. It was just a few months before the election, and white voters were angry.
By the time the election rolls around on November 8th, black voters, Republican voters, had been thoroughly intimidated here.
By all accounts, the elections of 1898 were a sham. The Democratic Party had a paramilitary group called the Red Shirts. They attacked and blocked black residents from voting. At a rally just before the election, Alfred Moore Waddell provoked the crowds. He said, "Negro office holding ought at once and forever be brought to an end, even if we have to choke the current of the Cape Fear River with carcasses." The votes were counted, and the Democrats won.
Democratic candidates won every seat they had a candidate up for election in.
But some local fusionist politicians remained in power because their seats hadn't been up for re-election, like the white Republican mayor and the Board of Aldermen. And, of course, the election did nothing to undo the economic power black folks held in the city. The Democrats had won the election, but their goal of total white supremacist control remained out of reach.
And so they engineered what was essentially a coup d'etat.
The day after the election, at a gathering for white men in Wilmington, the Democrats unveiled a document called the White Declaration of Independence. It contained an ultimatum. Cynthia Brown, whose descendants were in Wilmington back in 1898, is a historian at her church, where there's a preserved copy of the declaration from the next day's newspaper.
"We will no longer be ruled and will never again be ruled by men of African origin."
They would strip black men of voting rights. They would give white men a large part of the employment heretofore given to black men. And as for Alex Manley, "We demand that he leave this city forever within 24 hours. The next morning, hundreds of white men marched to the offices of the Daily Record. Manley was gone. He had fled to save his own life. They set the Daily Record building on fire. This is where it once stood.
once the white leadership destroyed Alex Manly's printing press, they destroyed one way in which the African-American community in Wilmington could organize itself and keep itself informed.
At City Hall, the mayor and Board of Aldermen were forced out.
There's 200 armed men in City Hall at the time. They didn't do it of their own free will. And as they resigned, a new member selected by the Democratic Party was voted into office.
Waddell, who once threatened to fill the Cape Fear River with black bodies, was the new mayor of Wilmington. Meanwhile, the mob had grown to about 2,000 men, and the violence spilled into the streets. In these photos, X's mark where the first black residents were killed.
The stories are that they were dumped into the river, and there are varying stories about how many people were killed.
I see 40 to 60 clearly as fatalities as a result of the violence, but I think it was higher.
Many black residents hid for days in the swamps and the wooded cemeteries in the city, including Cynthia's great-grandmother. And thousands of other residents fled Wilmington, never to return. Shortly afterward, Democrats printed booklets celebrating a glorious victory, and in the newspapers depicted black residents as the instigators.
This image is a gross misrepresentation of what actually happened during 1898. You know, what you see is African-American men with guns, not white men with machine guns.
The city never regained its black majority population. Jim Crow laws, like literacy tests and poll taxes that prevented black people from voting, were immediately enacted, and Wilmington's spirit of black opportunity was crushed. Black political representation in the state was over. It would be 90 years until North Carolina elected its next black Congress member.
Wilmington did a really great job of covering up a very dark past for a very long time.
Over the years, the textbooks on North Carolina's history have struggled to accurately describe what happened in 1898. This one from 1933 says the situation was unfortunate for both races. And this one from 1978 doesn't have that much more detail. But they both praise Charles Aycock, a politician who helped perpetrate the riot. They say he had a keen mind and a kind heart, and that, in fact, he was one of the best friends that the colored people had in the state. It's a legacy that North Carolina has yet to fully undo. The names of the perpetrators are on Wilmington's school buildings and city parks. But the legacy is also bigger than those names. Turn on the news and the state's long history of political suppression echoes.
And we turn to a strict new voter ID law in North Carolina. Racial gerrymandering and a push for new voting maps.
The court says the Republican-led legislature redrew congressional districts along racial lines, violating the Constitution.
There's a tremendous amount of intimidation that is still felt by the black community.
It doesn't have to be mass mayhem and violence in the streets.
The strategy shifts towards designing state laws in such a way that you could exclude blacks from voter participation.
The subliminal pursuit of continuing the white Declaration of Independence.
And if you don't see it for what it really is, it can happen all over again.
There you go. Once again, and we have more. We're going to take a break. When we come back from the break, brothers and sisters, we'll continue with this discussion and listen to more testimony on the massacres of African people without any justification, just outside of just evilness, mean-spiritedness. You're listening to African Perspectives here on the Motherland Media Network on timeforanawakening.com and blacktalkradionetwork.com. We'll be right back. You stick with us.
You are listening to African Perspectives with host Brother Oshie on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
I'm ready. I can dig strapping. But I can't dig that backstabbing.
Oh, no.
The brother getting ready. That's the bank. Getting ready. Hit him, Fred, hit him.
You are listening to Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts or live programming, hit them up at timeforanawakening.com.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters. You're listening to African Perspectives here on the Motherland Media Network on timeforanawakening.com and blacktalkradionetwork.com. Other programming that we have here on Time for an Awakening Media on Mondays, of course, this program Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. All times are going to give our Eastern times. But this evening, Acres of Diamonds from 6 to 8, followed by Let's Buy Black, 365 from 8 to 9. And then 9 to 10, Conversation Reparations with Brother Jamoke and Sister Lacey. On Tuesdays, Black Reality Think Tank with Dr. William Rogers at 8 p.m. On Wednesdays, Revive with Sister POC from 8 to 10 on Wednesday. And then on Thursdays, Relationships with Joy and Troy at 7 p.m. on Thursdays. And Friday, 8 p.m. Friday, Time for an Awakening with Brother Elliot and Brother Richard. And then on Sunday, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., it's Revive with Sister POC. And then Sunday evening at 7 p.m., it's Time for an Awakening once again with Brother Elliot and Brother Richard. Every Monday through Friday from 10 p.m. Eastern to 12 a.m., the Warren Ballantyne Show. Right here on Time for an Awakening Media. And the number to call is 215-490-9832. 215-490-9832. Yeah, I want to thank Galaxy Radio, Dr. Adu, and especially Brother Paul for hooking us up. So I had a chance to talk to Dr. Abu, on his radio program yesterday morning, 6 o'clock in the a.m. here, you know, but it's 5 hours different. It was 11 o'clock there, and so from 11 to 12, and I'll be back again on this Sunday coming up. No, I may not be because I'll be traveling. Never mind. Yes, I'll give Brother Paul a call to let him know, tell Dr. Abu that I will be back again the following Sunday because I'll be leaving Tulsa, Oklahoma around that time. So, but anyway, you know, what is deep and sad and like, you know, last year, because we were hung up on the 400 years of our sojourn here, 1619 and then 2019, that we really didn't talk about 100 years previous, the red hot summer of 1919, of the amount of disturbances, massacres, riots, you name it, where our brothers were fighting, just coming back from the Civil War, just coming back from World War I, and some of the stuff that they were humiliated, they were denigrated, they were degraded and demeaned, and, you know, some of them brothers had them guns, and so they fought back, you know. That's why I'm going to tell you, I love us fighting back, even if it means that we get decimated, but we fight back, because once again, we were not slaves. We were captives. A slave is somebody or something that submits its will to a master. It won't fight back. But a captive will do anything and everything in his power to resist. That's why in all the things that I've learned over these many years, I did not learn them in the Monkey public school system. Because, of course, I went to school in the 50s and 60s. And you only learn about Frederick Douglass. No, you didn't even learn about Frederick Douglass. You learned about Booker T. Washington and George Washington Carver. You didn't even learn about Frederick Douglass because why? Frederick Douglass resisted. Frederick Douglass took the whip from the so-called and whooped that. And yes, he did. He whooped that ass and then he knew he got to get up out of there because they were going to kill him. So he left out of Maryland and went straight north into Massachusetts. Then you learn about Harriet Tubman. You don't learn about people who resist. Just like you don't learn about Nat Turner. Well, you sure in hell won't learn about Nat Turner killing all them white folks. So I gravitated to those who resist. That's why I gravitated to Malcolm. Those who had a stronger voice against this oppressive system and European people. That's why I love strong African leaders like that, which, of course, today they're very, very few. Very few. We're going to get back to the subject, and you can give us a call right here at 215-490-9832. 215-490-9832. We're talking about the massacres against our people. This is Atlanta, 1906. Like many massacres, the violence in Atlanta at the turn of the century began with a Caucasian woman accusing a man of rape. On September 22, 1906, Atlanta newspapers reported that four Caucasian women allegedly were assaulted by American African men, a claim that was completely unfounded. In reality, Caucasians were threatened by upward mobility of the American African communities in Atlanta, which they believed were taking away their jobs. This bogus report of sexual assault drove as many as 2,000 Caucasian men into the streets, and they went into our community to beat, stab, and shoot any person they saw. PBS reports a disabled man was chased down and beaten to death. Communities were destroyed, and unofficial death toll was up to 100 people. And that's what happens. That's what happens, believe me. You know?
The Atlanta race riot occurred September 22nd through 24th in 1906. There was a lot of tension in the air amongst whites and blacks. There were several causes of the race riot. There was job competition for the first time between whites and blacks, and this frustrated a lot of whites. People like Alonzo Herndon would frustrate whites because there became this kind of a social elite class of blacks who were doing well, better than some of the whites.
Alonzo Herndon was an incredibly inventive and successful entrepreneur who was born into slavery, learned the trade of barbering, and came to Atlanta and established a barber shop. And it was a barber shop that had African-American barbers who cut hair for white men. And so he was able to establish a very successful business. There was a way of suppressing black participation in political life, relegating African Americans to a second class status. And part of making that happen was for white people to vilify African Americans.
During political campaigns, a lot of candidates believe if they were more racist than the other candidate, they would get more white votes. And so you had a lot of just racial rhetoric. A couple of the newspapers printed stories that were untrue about black men assaulting white women.
There was a guy running for governor named Hoke Smith, and Hoke Smith played off the white fears. In his speeches, he talked about the newspaper articles, the crimes against white women being committed by blacks, and he said that black disenfranchisement was necessary to, quote, put blacks or keep blacks in their place. And so he added fuel to the fire.
So with all this climate, on September 22nd, 1906, white mobs began to assemble downtown.
They took to the streets, and they just began attacking blacks. They began pulling them off the trolley cars. They began choking them, smothering them.
They began attacking African-American businesses like Alonzo Herndon at the barbershop, and a number of African-Americans were killed as well as wounded by the mobs. The governor didn't immediately call out the state militia, but eventually it was clear that the Atlanta City Police could not disperse the mob, and so the militia was called out, but violence continued for several days, and the response of the African-American community was to defend themselves.
And black people began to fight back. When this occurred, there were some white bodies who fell.
There were dozens of blacks killed, hundreds were injured, tremendous property damage was done.
The business leaders quickly got together because it was one thing to have the suppression of African Americans, but it was another thing to have riots that was bad for business.
The white leaders of Atlanta were also concerned about how Atlanta was viewed around the world. The press began to talk about how racist Atlanta looked, and so the white civic leaders reached out to black elites, and they worked out a compromise to quell the violence. And there were black businesses that operated downtown, and so it was agreement that that would be segregated, and what came to be known as Sweet Auburn was created as a central black business district. Black people were no longer operating all throughout downtown any longer. So segregation was reinforced. Black people were blamed for the causes of the riot. But there was agreement that they wouldn't allow the mob to continue to attack black communities any longer.
The white leaders were intent on further suppressing African-American rights. And so the African-American participants in this process were looking for safety, but in the long run, they were not successful in maintaining the voting rights that they had before the riot took place. And the response was further disfranchisement of African-Americans to make sure that they didn't have any effect on voting. And so in the legislative session that followed in 1907, the state passed a disfranchisement law that reduced the black electorate from 25% of African Americans voting to 4%. And that held true then for most of the first half of the 20th century.
Yeah, once again, the disenfranchisement going back to business as usual. That's why I maintain there is, believe me, well, you don't have to believe me. You can do the research for yourself. There is no way that these Caucasians will ever treat us with dignity and respect. And somehow, I know we hold out all this hope. We pray, we wish, we demonstrate, we march, we vote, hoping that there will be a deep fundamental change in the attitudes and behaviors of Caucasians and allow us to share in the stolen property and wealth that they have created. The wealth gap is so damn huge, that'll never happen. We will never economically be on a par with Caucasians in this country, literally in this world. Yeah, sad but true. Sad but true. So we're going to go to Atlanta. This one I didn't know until recently, I'd say maybe about 3 or 5 years ago, Elaine, Arkansas. The Encyclopedia of Arkansas calls the Elaine Massacre by far the deadliest racial confrontation in Arkansas's history and possibly the bloodiest racial conflict in the history of the United States. American Africans outnumbered Caucasians 10 to 1 and were demanding economic justice as many of them were forced into sharecropping. A union was created to protect sharecroppers, and Caucasians were outraged at even the smallest move toward equality. In September of 1919, there was a union meeting among American African workers. Caucasians showed up to riot. As a result, one Caucasian man was shot and killed. Caucasians convinced themselves that there was a threat of American African insurrection, and as usual, you react with violence. Hundreds of Caucasian men attacked American African residents, but many fought back, including American African veterans. Sadly, there were reports of over 200 American African people, including children, were killed. Many were killed, were arrested. Many who weren't killed were arrested and tortured while in custody. They were forced to confess about an insurrection, with 12 men receiving a death penalty. They eventually became known as the Elaine 12. With the help of the NAACP, their case went before the Supreme Court in 1923, and they were exonerated. This was one of the first times the NAACP won a case in front of the Supreme Court. Yeah. Did they receive any restitution? Right.
It was called the Red Summer of 1919. Named for the blood that ran through America's cities during months of racial unrest. African-American soldiers had returned home from the Great War, World War I, to a country still teeming with discrimination. And in their quest for civil rights, tensions between blacks and whites reached a tipping point. Deadly race riots broke out in over 24 cities, but one rural town, Elaine, Arkansas, would become the epicenter for the bloodshed. The violence there, lynch mobs, torture, indiscriminate was so horrific, it would go down in history not as a race riot, but as the Elaine Massacre. This is history. Dark history. 5,000 African-American soldiers enlisted to serve. But while they fought for democracy abroad, their own country, America, was still not willing to see them as equal.
White supremacy was very mainstream at this time in the United States. Basically, a lot of African Americans were seeking to obtain their full rights and equality in the United States. And violence was often used by mobs of whites.
Tensions reached a boiling point in the summer of 1919. Race riots broke out in dozens of cities across the country. But in the rural South, something even more menacing was taking form. There, slavery existed in all but name. In a system called sharecropping, farmers provided landowners with labor for a share of crops produced. But the system was rigged. Sharecroppers were often kept in perpetual debt.
One black sharecropper raised $500 worth of cotton, and his landlord told him, "Yeah, but you used $697 worth of supplies, so you owe me money."
Everyone who has any power at this point is working to make sure they keep African-American laborers tied to the land.
For roughly 50 years, the system went unchecked. In the fall of 1918, a black man from Arkansas had had enough. Robert Hill had decided to form a union to represent sharecroppers. It was a dangerous decision, and one that would set off a chain of events involving mass murder, torture, and a landmark Supreme Court ruling. But first, he would need to organize.
In his message, Hill was pretty simple and direct. Why is it that we cannot have fair payment for the honest and hard work we do?
Despite the inherent risk involved with challenging whites, World War I veterans and other black sharecroppers became card-carrying members of the Progressive Farmers and Household Union of America.
He believed that by paying dues, these members could have the services of lawyers and sue plantation owners for cotton that had been stolen from them and false numbers that had been placed in the plantation stores' books.
On the night of September 30th, 1919, union members gathered in Elaine to discuss their legal plan.
This is in Phillips County. It's basically just a crossroads at this time, a road, a few houses, a railroad siding, no streetlights. There's also a one-room wooden church, and that's where the union met. Expecting that they might have trouble, the union posted a guard of about six men. They had shotguns and rifles. The meeting's taking place, and while they're having this discussion, a car rolls up the road.
Two white men were in the car.
By one account, one of the white men in the car said, "You all get away from there." And shortly thereafter, a shot was fired.
Though it remains unclear who fired first, a barrage of gunfire broke out. One of the white men was killed almost instantly. The rumor of a black uprising spread in a matter of hours. The idea of a sharecropper rebellion conveniently played into the hands of landowners who did not want their sharecropping practices scrutinized. They did all they could, as quickly as they could, to sound alarms that black farmers were out for white blood.
The story gets magnified that the town is under attack, that blacks are killing people in the streets, that there is a revolution afoot.
The sharecroppers quickly formed self-defense groups, expecting repercussions over the death of a white man. But they could not have predicted just how severe the response would be. The following morning, under the watchful eye of Sheriff Frank Kitchens and his deputies, posses of white men were sent to find, detain, and kill the offenders.
When you have an out-of-control mob just being told there's a Negro insurrection going on, that mob's being very indiscriminate in its violence. You see houses being attacked, black-owned homes being ransacked.
The black school was burnt. Notable families were killed.
Black women and children have to go literally hide out in the woods because many of these people are indiscriminately shooting at African-American women and their children.
Black veterans and other African-Americans took up arms in self-defense.
This no doubt just feeds into the mob fervor. The fact that, oh, they're daring to shoot back at us. This must really be an insurrection.
One historian has identified more than 20 different killing sites where African Americans were being killed.
There are stories that mob members were taking souvenirs, such as ears or fingers, from the bodies of fallen African Americans.
One of the leading black families of the county, they weren't even in the town. They had just received a brother back from the French front. They are pulled from a train, put in the back of a car, and they are stabbed, shot, and their mutilated bodies are left on the side of the road.
Within 2 days, 500 U.S. troops were sent to quell the supposed black uprising.
they don't find any blacks killing or shooting down the streets. In fact, Colonel Jenks reports that the city is filled with hundreds and hundreds of white men with guns. Many of the individuals who were hiding in the thickets were former soldiers who had just gotten back from the war. And when they see the army troops come, they rush out, believing that the army troops are there to assist them. The army believes that these people are rushing toward them to attack, and they're cut down by machine gun fire.
Although the exact number will never be known, a recent estimate suggests 237 black men, women, and children were killed. There was an immediate demand for justice, but not for the black lives lost. Five white men were also killed in the fighting. Hundreds of African Americans were rounded up and put in jail, and when the jail was full, they detained the rest in a schoolhouse.
While they are detained, there is torture going on.
The goal? To elicit false confessions of a black uprising.
They whipped the men, whipped them for long periods of time. They stuffed formaldehyde up their noses, and they stripped them naked and shocked them with electrical charges. They did this until they confessed to the conspiracy.
Robert Hill escaped to Kansas, but his peers back in Arkansas were not as lucky. 122 indictments were issued, and trials quickly started.
The men were brought into the court in chains. They weren't allowed to consult with their defense attorney. The defense attorney rarely interjected. And then the all-white juries started delivering guilty verdicts. In one case, the guilty verdicts came back in 2 minutes.
It's also important to point out that there were mobs of people outside who were demanding black blood. Governor Bruff maintained that at some point these people would be killed, but they would have to have been killed justly.
The governor lived up to his word when among the 87 black citizens charged with crimes, 12 were sentenced to death by electric chair. Despite the system being blatantly rigged against them, the convicted men had one unlikely beacon of hope. The American justice system. The trials of the Elaine 12 had been highly publicized. The NAACP took notice and stepped in with legal help for the 12. For 4 years, the team faced a series of legal setbacks and advances, until in 1923, the case made its way to the Supreme Court in what is now known as Moore versus Dempsey. There, the defense argued that the original trials had been mob-dominated, and the black prisoners had been denied their constitutional rights. In a landmark decision, the court agreed.
The good that comes out of this is that the NAACP sees for the first time that it can win in the Supreme Court, that things don't always fall along the color lines.
The 12, subjected to torture, injustice, and litigation travesty, were at long last exonerated and released in January 1925. They might have escaped with their lives, but there was nothing that could reverse the pain and devastation felt by the black community in Phillips County, and no way to unsee the ungodly truth that American men, alongside the American government, were complicit in a massacre of American citizens on American soil.
We as a nation have grown and we continue to grow. We don't need to pretend as if we've always had everything figured out. But if we are to do justice to who we are as Americans, we've got to own all of it.
And nothing, of course, there was no restitution once again. There was nothing done to make those people whole. There was nothing done to bring that community back to what it should have been. And so it continues to be what it is. I'm going to do a couple more here, and then I'm going to open up the phone lines. And, of course, the number to call is 215-490-9832. 215-490-9832. Rosewood, Florida. I found out about Rosewood back in early 80s. Found about Rosewood. And of course, they eliminated Rosewood off the map. You could not find Rosewood on the map. They eliminated that town. Similar to the massacre in Tulsa in 1921, an American African community was burned to the ground 2 years later after a Caucasian woman, Fannie Taylor, claimed she was assaulted by an American African man on January 1st of 1923. The first person killed was Sam Carter, a local blacksmith. He was tortured and his mutilated body was hung from a tree. Sam Carter was one of many. There are reports as up to 150 American African people were killed in Rosewood, Florida. After Rosewood was destroyed, a grand jury and a special prosecutor decided that there was not enough evidence to prosecute the Caucasian men who killed innocent American citizens. In 1997, the late filmmaker John Singleton famously made the film Rosewood, starring Ving Rhames, based on the massacre. Yeah. Also, as I said earlier, it's ironic that John Voight, who played a Caucasian, you know, you always got to, in these movies, you always got to have a good Caucasian. See, you just can't make the Caucasian so damn evil like he really is. Because you're trying to sell the movie, you know? You're trying to sell the movies just like, you know, all those other so-called slave movies. I hate them. You know, God had the benevolent Caucasian, even in Wakanda. You know, the CIA was a, yeah. So, Rosewood, 1923.
On January 5th, 1923, a white vigilante mob in Florida ended a two-day rampage. It resulted in the predominantly black town of Rosewood being burned to the ground. It was triggered a few days earlier in the neighboring community of Sumner, Florida, when a 16-year-old married white woman, Fanny Taylor, claimed that a black man, Jesse Hunter, had assaulted her. Several groups of white men assembled to capture Hunter, believing that he had fled and was hiding in Rosewood with the help of the black community. At least one black man who was believed to have information about the assault was lynched. The dead man's body was strung up and displayed as a warning to the black community. Over the next few days, as news of the alleged assault spread, several hundred angry white men descended upon Rosewood. A gunfight between whites and blacks ensued, and many homes and other buildings were burned. When it was over, an estimated 30 black men, women, and children had been killed. Other black residents escaped into the nearby woods, then fled by train to Gainesville, never to return. Years later, survivors of the rampage recounted that Fanny Taylor had made false accusations against Jesse Hunter to cover up her extramarital affair with a white man.
Yeah, I know. It's always the white woman. Our thirst and lust for white women. Man. I think that's it. I believe that's it, brothers and sisters, of the ones that we had. As you can see, and what's ironic about Atlanta, when he talked about Sweet Auburn Avenue, where Dr. King's birth home is, it's a national landmark, controlled by the U.S., I think, Force Administration, as well as the museum and the center located on Auburn Avenue. Albert and Boulevard, and then going east of there, no, going west of there, Auburn Avenue Seafood, a number of the places, Auburn Avenue Research Library is near there. But what's ironic is that a lot of that is being gentrified. That's right. Atlanta is being seriously gentrified of areas that once were stalwart communities for American African people here in the city of Atlanta. But it's not surprising because it's happening all over the country. Caucasians who escaped the cities and the center cities or inner cities or the ghetto, moving out to suburbs and gated communities and subdivisions and so forth because of those commutes. And a lot of the entertainment is in the city and restaurants and so forth. So they want to move back, move into those townhouses and other buildings and so forth. They want to move back. And so I think what we have to do, dear brothers and sisters, is come to the reality that this is not ours. It is theirs. And what they want to do is to maintain and sustain the control that they've created for themselves. You got a caller, 646-646. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Brother Oshie. What's happening?
Hey, Jay, how you doing?
I'm good, man. I see you talking about some of the dirtiest, nastiest, filthiest, stinking people on the planet. Yeah. I mean, you know, it's like talking about dirt, man. You know, you got to stay away from dirt.
Yeah, well, you know, there have been some very mean-spirited people, man. And one can make the argument as part of their evolutionary human development, as Dr. Sheikh Anjab. Go ahead.
And you know the Negro's not going to give up their white daddy. There's nothing they can do to give him up.
No.
You know, all those people was in that praising and glorifying and looking up to that devil.
Who you? But Jay, you broke up. So what did you say? Just
come to the point to just give them to him, let him have them, move on, forget about them, cast them aside, think about ways to take them out of the community altogether, and just go straight black.
Yeah, well, you know, see, what we don't understand is that when they took the chains off our ankles and off our necks and wrists, the chains on our minds are even deeper, more everlasting. Because if I can make you, just like Carter G. Woodson said, if I can make you an outcast and render you an outcast, you'll be an outcast. If I keep sending you to the back door, even when there is no back door, you'll want one because of your training has told you that's what you're supposed to have. See? And so
that's what they do.
Yeah. So the destruction of the African mind is what's really is the deepest part of this whole experience that we're having. Yes, they vamped on those communities and they killed us. It was terror. It was horrifying.
They got you on what one would call, Brother Oshie, remote control. That's all. The white man got the mind of our people on remote control. They control and dictate how we act and respond in every facet of our lives. We just don't want to admit it. We allow people who have mistreated us, disrespect us, done all sorts of things to us to lead and guide us. How could any sane black person stand behind that filthy dog, Joe Biden?
I know.
And to watch a Negro like Jim Clyburn,
I know,
make it seem like he's the reason.
Right. Well, he is.
Come on.
He is the reason why those brothers and sisters, unfortunately, in serious mass, voted for, in a huge vote for Joe Biden. He has never won a primary. He's ran for president, I think, two times before for sure, and has never won a primary. And now he wins one, and now let's going to see what's going to happen tomorrow, how he does tomorrow. That's going to be the real deal. But I can give less than a rat's ass about that, I tell you, because it doesn't make any difference.
I do, too. I think it's a misguided direction based on what's ahead of us. See, nobody's talking about there's hard times coming. And when I say hard times coming, I mean hard times coming. And there's going to be some that's going to survive, and then there's going to be those that's not going to survive. What you want to be in the position is to just be able to do what you do. You know, and unfortunately, our people are not in the position to do what you got to do and survive. There's going to be some that's going to, you know, flourish in this situation that's ahead of us. And then there's going to be those that it is what it is. You know, I look at it like this. Until we come together collectively, we're going to always be in the position of being at the bottom, because every other nationality is coming together. They're doing the necessary things for their people to survive. They have community. They have all of the necessary things in a place to survive when it comes to a crisis within their community. We don't have that. You know, everybody talks about gentrification, but does anybody ever talk about where gentrification happens at? Do you ever hear other communities being gentrified? But nobody talks about that. You see what I'm saying? Who's the attack of gentrification against? People of color, black people.
Right.
In the Puerto Rican communities or other communities to gentrify. You know why? Because of the key word. It's their community. It's the Chinese community. It's the Italian. It's the community to where as they have a solidified base there of ownership and controlling of the resources in that community. The only people that this happened to is the Negro. But nobody talks about it.
Well, you know, they're because our communities were turned over to us. We were there, and they were turned over to us when European Jews and Caucasians left out.
Wanted to get away from your black ass.
Exactly. But then they said, hey, I don't want to make this long commute. I don't want to waste all that gas money and so forth. And plus that, too, I'm tired of leaving work, going out home, and then come back into the city to enjoy nightlife, to enjoy theater and sporting events and so forth. I want to move into the city. You know, create some high rises, some condos, some other sprawling communities, some other subdivisions and so forth, because I want to move back into the city. And that's what has happened. And that's what is going on.
Think about it, though. Think about why is it that we as a people don't understand this? Why is it that we are always the last to see that we get in a foot in our behind?
Because, see,
why,
Jay, let me tell you. This is why, Jay. Because we have been bamboozled, hoodwinked, led astray. We believe in this system. We believe that it is just as much ours as it is the Caucasian. And and we believe in the court system to do what's right. Even in that Elaine, Arkansas, the Elaine, Arkansas 12, the overwhelming evidence of their freedom was the Supreme Court had no damn choice. They had
it's
no
a
damn
white
choice.
Man's country.
You know?
It's but a white man's country.
Exactly. It is theirs. And so they have the right to do what the hell they want to do. And so if they want to move in on your community, because ain't nothing yours. There's nothing yours,
you
Jay.
You ain't built nothing.
Right.
Humble, baby.
Exactly. So if I want to come in there and eliminate you, kick you out, kick you to the curb, I'll do so. And ain't a damn thing you or your legislators in city hall or county government, state government, federal government can do about it.
It's their right to be able to do it. How could you get mad? See, I never get mad at the Yerugu for that. Because it's his country. I tell people all the time.
Yeah.
It's a white man's country. Don't give me nothing about you built it. No, you were forced to build it, if anything. It wasn't under your free damn will to build it. You were beat, raped, caused. Everything done to you to make your black behind build it.
Yeah.
So how is it yours?
I hear you.
That's the problem.
I hear you.
You want to protect it instead of burning it down. If you come to my house and rape my mother and rape my sister and my brother, I'm only out to do one thing. That's to kill your ass.
Yeah.
I'm not out to give you no forgiveness, no nothing.
But see, we're trained. We're trained, Jay. Just like all those incidents that happened to us, and the first thing, even before somebody's even buried, we forgive you. We're trained. This is a training Europeans have. They have put something on. Jay, I gotta go. My time is up. You know, Hotep, Jay. I appreciate your call. I appreciate you listening.
I appreciate you, brother.
All right, man. All those who constantly listen, and those who call in to have conversation, appreciate that. But listen, brothers and sisters, we are at war for the minds of our people. We are at war for the minds of our people. We end this program, like we end all of our programs, with the words of Stephen Biko. The most potent weapon in the hands of the oppressor is the minds of the oppressed. This program is dedicated and committed to helping to free the African mind. But not just the M-I-N-D, but the M-I-N-E, because under the feet of African people lies all of the resources that everybody wants, think they can't do without, and they sure in hell don't want to pay for. Brothers and sisters, it is always an honor and pleasure to be on the radio to talk with you and to communicate with you. Once again, I'll talk about Black Wall Street on Wednesday. I'll be in Tulsa and looking at what Black Wall Street looked like today. I'll come back and give a report on what Black Wall Street is all about. It's a sad situation. But you remember the Gap Band, Greenwood, Archer, and Pine. That's the intersection of Black Wall Street, Greenwood, Archer, and Pine, the Gap Band. You dropped a bomb on me. Brothers and sisters, Shem Hotep means go in peace. Isante Sana means thank you. Bibi Fahodie. Bibi Fahodie means our victorious destiny. Brothers and sisters, we will be victorious. You have a blessed and wonderful day. Peace, family.